And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice.
Thank you so much for joining us for part two of our interview with Dr. Barry Jacobs. Dr. Barry Jacobs is a clinical psychologist, family therapist, and author of the book, The Emotional Survival Guide for Caregivers, Looking After Yourself and Your Family While Helping an Aging Parent.
They have to be willing to just create anew all the time,
right,
in order to make this work, again, through the months and years of caregiving.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you. But it does require a lot of courage, because the letting go of that control is a scary thing, especially for caregivers that have to have so many things they have to put together and keep together on a daily basis. To let go of that control takes courage. But once they're able to do that and problem solve, then, of course, there's a lot of benefit to that. But it does take some level of risk.
I think that it takes the ability to stand back and say, the way I've been doing this is no longer working.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that takes a certain kind of self-effacement,
right,
and just ability to strike off in a new direction if need be,
right,
to really see this whole thing as a dynamic process,
mm-hmm,
that we're changing, they're changing. And, you know, we have to use all of our creative juices to come up with the very best solution at any given time.
I like that. Dynamic process. Caregiving definitely is a dynamic process, that's for sure. So one of the chapters in your book, which I thought was very interesting, talks about protecting intimacy. Talk to me a little bit about what you mean with that.
So none of us are just one family role. It's not that we're just a spouse or we're just an adult child, you know, caring for an aging parent. Mm-hmm. We all have multiple roles. So, you know, so I'm a son and a husband and a father and a brother and a cousin. And I have relationships with various people in my family, and I have responsibilities towards various people in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I put too much time and energy in one of those roles, and maybe the caregiving role for my mother nowadays, who has dementia, then it really comes at the expense of the time and energy that I'm able to devote to these other family relationships. And so protecting intimacy is about finding ways of striking a balance between my caregiving responsibilities and my other caring responsibilities,
mm-hmm,
in particular, my relationship with my wife. I need to, my children are now a little bit older. We're empty nesters now. So my wife and I are home, and my wife understands that I need to devote time to my mother, and she also devotes time to my mother, but that I have to protect time,
mm-hmm,
where she and I can be a couple, and where my mother's problems don't intrude on our marriage. And that is often very challenging, especially as problems arise. But we work very hard to strike that balance,
mm-hmm,
protect the intimacy of our relationship.
Absolutely. And remembering that healthy sacrifice and setting those boundaries, right?
Correct.
Absolutely. So talk to me a little bit now more about the last days. In your book, you do mention that. What do you suggest that a caregiver can do to prepare themselves for that?
There are many people who are writing with a lot of insight today about end-of-life care. I'll just mention a few things that others have mentioned. I mean, first, there are certainly a certain amount of legal preparation that must be done. I mean, caregivers do themselves and the rest of the family enormous good by having the care recipient prepare a living will or advance directive. It's called different things in different states. But the idea is for everyone in the family to know what the care recipient's wishes are in regards to getting emergency medical care, or how aggressive medical treatment should be at the end of life. When that is spelled out in the legal document by a care recipient, then it enables all the caregivers to come together at the end of that person's life, rather than get caught in endless debate about what their loved one might want or what their loved one should have, which unfortunately that kind of debating often leads to weakened family bonds when their loved one finally dies.
Mm-hmm.
So that legal document is extremely important. I think for the family as a whole to understand kind of what phase their loved one has reached. So, you know, and we talk about there being, three different phases to any illness. So we talk about the acute phase where someone has gotten sick, maybe they had a stroke, maybe they had a heart attack, where there's the immediate medical emergency. And then we talk about it, usually a long chronic phase where the person has symptoms. Those symptoms may change gradually over time, but relatively speaking, they're stable. But then what happens is people ultimately go from the chronic stage to the terminal phase. And many times family members don't recognize that their loved one has passed from the chronic stage to the terminal phase. Mm-hmm. Their loved one may have gone in and out of the hospital 10 times. And when their loved one goes into the hospital an 11th time, they just expect, well, they're going to get out again and everything's life's going to go on just like it did before. Mm-hmm. But something has changed. And with that last hospitalization, the person is no longer has the ability to bounce back any longer. And so it's we're not talking about a chronic phase any longer. We're talking about the family as a whole being preparing to let their loved one go, and to you know wish them well and you know bid them well as they pass on to the next world. And that's very hard for family members. It's very sad. Oftentimes, every family member is not prepared for that, and you know different family members have different degrees of preparedness for that, and it takes a while for everybody to get on the same page. And when people are on the same page and they're able to join together, mm-hmm. and really express their love for the person who is dying at that point, it makes the bereavement process afterwards go much better, and it strengthens the family bond. So the family has a sense of having accomplished this great task of caring for and sending off their loved one. And without having the divisiveness that can occur when people are still arguing up until their loved one's dying breath. So that terminal phase, you know, it ought to be preceded by lots of conversation, the legal document, lots of discussion about what's coming down the pike. So everybody is getting emotionally prepared and maybe logistically prepared for dealing with that.
Very well said. And I have heard some professionals say that this conversation actually should be early, much earlier than what we usually do, because like you were expressing, sometimes there's an event that happens before most people are proactive enough to do the steps that are necessary. But that this conversation should really be earlier when the person is well and can communicate their own desires and thoughts. What is your opinion on that?
I agree with you. I mean, all of us should have living wills or advance directives. Mm-hmm. So about 10 years ago, only 20% of Americans had living wills. Today, 30% of Americans have living wills. Mm-hmm. So we've made progress, mm-hmm. but that still means it's the majority of this country does not have living wills. And the reason for that is people are afraid. They, mm-hmm. you know, they're afraid that if they plan for their last days, they plan for their demise, that somehow it's going to hasten their demise, that mm-hmm. there's a kind of magical thinking there that if I plan for it, it will happen. So people resist thinking about those things, and families, unfortunately, avoid talking about these things. But I can tell you, having you know worked in hospitals for many years and worked in intensive care units for many years, when families don't have the guidance of the person who's now in the ICU bed, maybe in a coma, those families struggle dearly. I mean, they have such a tough time making basic decisions about what their loved one might want. And that adds that the tragedy of family divisiveness on top of the tragedy of seeing their loved one passing.
This is your host, Rebecca. And now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
Specialized approach to spinal care is what you will find in the Advanced Spinal Care Clinic in Graham, Washington. Here's Dr. Craig Lipinski explaining why Nuke Care is unlike any other treatment.
Our goal is that we're making a specialized correction to the skull, the atlas, and the neck of each individual that is custom made or custom and specific created to get them healthy and then have them stay that way.
One of only 23 board certified NUCA practitioners in the world, Dr. Craig Lipinski offers you care that can significantly impact your health in positive ways.
This week we've seen somebody in here who's had a 50-point drop in blood pressure by having the skull, atlas, and neck corrected to a proper position.
To find out more about how NUCA Care can change your life, visit www.nuccawashington.com or call 253 253- 845-8181.
Those families struggle dearly. I mean, they have such a tough time making basic decisions about what their loved one might want. And that adds that the tragedy of family divisiveness on top of the tragedy of seeing their loved one passing.
Absolutely, because not only are you dealing with the pain of what's going on and the stress of that, but then you have to make those big decisions at that time as well. So you've kind of sprinkled a little bit of your mother's information and how you're dealing with some of that as well. Tell me a little bit about your mom.
Well, my mom is a great lady, first of all.
Awesome.
So my mother and stepfather were living in Florida for about 15 years, having a wonderful life, playing golf all the time, and enjoying their retirements. And then, unfortunately, my stepfather developed dementia about 7 or 8 years ago, and my mother was his caregiver. Mm-hmm. And because she herself was getting older and his dementia was getting worse, about 5 years ago, I moved the two of them from Florida up to live in an apartment very close to me in my current home outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. And unfortunately, my stepfather's condition got worse, and he died about 2 years ago. Mm. But my mother, she herself in the last 5 years has been steadily going downhill. She's been having small strokes. Mm. That little by little, she's been losing her functioning. So she's been losing her cognitive functioning, her memory, her ability to reason. Mm-hmm. And she's also been losing her ability to walk and losing her physical strength.
How old is mom?
My mom is now 85. Mm-hmm. You know, so just like any other caregiver, just like any other caregiving adult son, mm-hmm. I've had to figure out how to help her. And it's been very difficult because my mother is a proud woman, and she is someone who also has been much more comfortable in her life as a giver than as a receiver. Mm-hmm. And so here she was up until not that long ago being the caregiver for my stepfather, her husband. And now suddenly I'm turning to her and saying, Mom, you need help. Mm-hmm. I want to bring home health aides into your home. I want to bring Meals on Wheels into your home. And my mother's initial response to that was, you know, are you crazy? I don't need any of that. How dare you suggest that? Mm-hmm. You know, don't try to take over my life. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you're familiar with that kind of reaction.
Yes.
So, you know, it's been through a lot of cajoling, a lot of persuasion that originally I got her to accept having a home health aide come for two days a week, just for a few hours. Mm-hmm. And then gradually, as my mother has declined, I've had to increase the number of hours and days that the home health aides are coming in, mm-hmm. have put in other supports for her, you know, the medical alert and, mm-hmm. and other things like that. My mother has fought me tooth and nail on pretty much every new support I wanted to put in. Mm-hmm. But we're at the point now where, you know, my mother really needs aides coming in 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. She needs me to stop in 4 or 5 times a week and make sure things are okay. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned to you before this program started, my mother is currently in the hospital. She had a very bad fall 2 weeks ago.
Oh, sorry.
She didn't break anything, but she, mm-hmm. she bruised her one side of her body very badly. Mm-hmm. She is currently in rehab, you know, doing physical therapy and occupational therapy, mm-hmm. and will be going home in a few days. And I just literally this afternoon had a conversation with her where I said to her, again, you know, Mom, you're not functioning as well today as you were several months ago. I think we have to increase the amount of support you're going to have in the home yet again. Mm-hmm. My mother, you know, gave me an argument about it. But ultimately, I said to her, you know, please just trust me because I want you to be safe and I want you to be well. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to feel like I'm taking your freedom from you. I want to support you living in your apartment mm-hmm. for as long as is possible. And so with that, she agreed to have me increase the aides in her home.
Oh, good.
So we'll see how this goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just as I was mentioning before, this I've had to kind of constantly revise the caregiving plan. I've had to be in close contact with my brother and other family members who care about my mother in order to keep everybody on the same page about what my mother's needs are at this point. And to when people don't see her for a long period of time or they just have a short phone call with her, they don't really recognize that she's changing. Mm-hmm. So I want everybody to be aware. I want everybody to support her as much as they can and to pitch in as much as they can. So My mother handles her last days as well as possible. You know, and what I say about my family, and I say this in my work as a psychologist with other families, is I'm trying to help us all make a soft landing. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, you know, my mother is an old lady. You know, she's going to die. I want her to live as well and comfortably and with as much dignity as possible before mm-hmm. that happens. I don't want her to have falls and hurting herself.
Exactly.
At the same time, I don't want her to be living in an unfamiliar place with strangers. So,
right.
I'm trying to pull together the community resources in my community to enable her to live safely in her own apartment.
Absolutely. You know, so many people, like you did say, so many families struggle with that transition when their loved one needs the help, but they don't want to accept it or they don't want to acknowledge that they need it. Or maybe cognitively, they're not able to see that they need the help. And the family members are caught in this situation. I remember very clearly one day sitting in a doctor's office and I could hear the family members talking to their loved one, trying to find every single reason why they needed her to come and talk to the doctor so that the doctor would tell her that she needed to go and live with one of them. And it was,
right.
It was, you could just see their struggle.
Yeah. So I write a monthly column on family caregiving for AARP.org. And so my column last month was all about this topic about, you know, when do you give in and when do you take over?
Right.
And most of us, because especially when dealing with an aging parent, we love them. We don't want to, tread on their toes more than we have to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll defer to their judgment as long as we can. But unfortunately, just as you're pointing out, especially in the case of dementia,
mm-hmm.
people lose the capacity for insight.
Right.
They no longer can assess their own abilities well. And so to give you an example of that, when I sat down with my mother today and mm-hmm. said, I don't think you're as good as you were 3 months ago, given where you are today, her answer was, you're kidding. I'm fine. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she could no longer recognize that she's walking more slowly, that she's sleeping more, that she's falling more.
Mm-hmm.
And so because she lacks that insight,
right.
I have to use my best judgment instead of hers by way of doing her the best good. And so now it's, you know, little by little, I've had to make more decisions for her
mm-hmm.
And take over in a matter of speaking in order to allow her to live the way she wants to live. Because left to her own druthers, she wouldn't be able to make the decisions in order to take on the safety supports to stay in her home.
Absolutely.
But that tension between giving in to a parent and taking over from a parent, that is a an excruciating mm-hmm. tension that exists for long periods of time.
Absolutely. And so you are now experiencing that tension yourself as a caregiver. And my question to you is, what are you doing to help yourself stay healthy and positive?
Well, I have a wonderful wife, and that certainly helps. And
that does.
Yeah. And what I've been doing actually is I'm taking some of my personal caregiving experiences and using it to inform my professional activities.
Mm-hmm.
So not that I sit around, you know, telling my psychotherapy clients all about my mother. I don't do that. But certainly when I'm listening to people about their own family situations, their family situations often, ring chords for me, given my family story. And it helps me respond to them in as human and as understanding a way as possible. So that enriches my professional
mm-hmm.
work. Aside from that, I mean, I'm an avid athlete, and I'm 57 years old, and I still get out there on the basketball court and, you know, get beat up by younger guys, and you know, that's a lot of fun. And I have my brother and my cousins, all of whom love my mother. Particularly this past year, they have made an effort to reach out to me and
mm-hmm.
inquire how I'm doing and step up and take over some of the caregiving responsibilities. So I get some respite at times.
Mm-hmm.
I just came back from 2 weeks and a week and a half in Alaska. You know,
great.
I can't complain very much. It was a wonderful trip. But in order for me to do that, my brother came down from Rochester, New York to help take care of my mother for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
My cousins pitched in their way. So, you know, I'm fortunate that my extended family has also been there for me. And I have accepted the help that they've offered. I haven't rejected it because I know that I need it.
Right, right. And that is, I think, one of the most significant things you can do as a caregiver, except that you're going to need the help. And obviously, that is what one of the things that appears to be giving you a lot of strength as you're going in this pathway, in this journey. So you're getting a lot of support from family members, friends, and you can relate to your patients quite well. You're taking some nice vacations to some beautiful and wild places in the United States. And then you're also doing physical exercise, which is extremely important, I believe, for caregiving survival, would you say?
I would say it's essential for everybody in any life circumstance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, especially caregivers, I mean, what happens is we put our loved ones' needs ahead of our own, and we tend to sacrifice the hours that we would typically spend on our own health. And that is just a recipe for disaster in the long run. I have seen it with clients in my wife's family where the caregivers have allowed themselves to become unhealthy, especially when they've had their own chronic illnesses that they haven't taken care of. Mm-hmm. And then as a consequence, they wind up dying before the care recipient dies. And that's just an awful situation. So physical exercise is wonderful for our physical health, is wonderful for our mental health. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful for blowing off steam. And I mean, there's more and more evidence to suggest that it's probably the best thing that we could all do in order to prevent becoming demented ourselves. Everybody who has a loved one with dementia, a parent with dementia, they're always concerned, is this genetically based and am I going to get dementia? And truth be told, given our understanding of dementia today, most of the cause of dementia is not, it's not inheritance. It's not what we get from our parents. But if we want to prevent dementia, we shouldn't be kind of sitting on the front porch doing crossword puzzles. We should be doing physical exercise, maintaining our cardiovascular health, because that's our best bet for keeping our brains healthy as we age.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for that advice. I'm sure all of the caregivers that are listening can see that maintaining a healthy cardio system is probably a smart thing to do. So thank you for that. Now, you also told me that you have a new book coming up. Tell me a little bit about your new book and what is the title?
So I mentioned that I've been running a monthly column for AARP for a couple of years now. So AARP is in the process of putting out a series of books on family caregiving, as well as other subjects related to aging. And so myself and my wife, Julie Mayer, are writing a book for AARP on family caregiving. It's called AARP Time for Me. And just from the title, you can see it's about helping caregivers really engage in self-care. And in this book, we're telling the stories of lots of different caregivers and some of the emotions that they go through, but also some of the ways that they grow through caregiving. Too often, what we read about in books or in the press or we hear on television programs highlights the very negative aspects of family caregiving. But as more research shows, there are many positive aspects of family caregiving. I mean, people who are caregivers grow personally and spiritually. And there's actually evidence to suggest that some caregivers live longer than they would otherwise.
Wow.
You know, I'm thinking specifically of the work of David Roth, who's a researcher at Johns Hopkins, who has done a lot of epidemiological studies along these lines in recent years. So what I would say in our book, this AARP Time for Me, is we're trying to highlight the positive aspects of caregiving so that people can really grow through these roles. And so at the end of the day, when their loved one has died and the caregiving is over, people can pat themselves on the back and say, I did the very best that I could do, and I'm really glad for having had the opportunity to care for my loved one the way I did. And I'm really a more mature and better person and more competent person for having faced the challenges of caregiving.
Oh, that's beautifully said. And, you know, I always say that I've learned more from my parents as a caregiver than as a child when they were trying to tell me all those things that I should be and do and install all those values. It seems like as an adult, what they did is that they kind of said to me, okay, now it's time to practice all of those things. And I have been able to have the pleasure to do that. So would you come back to our program and talk to us about your new book when it's finished?
I would love to. And maybe I'll have my wife join us too.
Oh, that would be lovely.
She's far better spoken than I am.
Oh, you speak quite well. They would be happy to have you and your wife, Dr. Jacobs. So Dr. Jacobs, I would like you to just give us your best advice. If you have to tell a caregiver just one thing that they need to remember, what would that be?
It's hard to choose one thing, but essentially be kind to yourself. Mm. It sounds so simple. Mm-hmm. And yet caregivers are notoriously hard on themselves. Mm-hmm. They notoriously neglect their own health and their own social needs. When people are kind to themselves and really love themselves and replenish themselves, mm-hmm. then they're in a much better position to give to others. And then we are all of us doing the best that we can. Mm-hmm. And then we have to live with the limits of our capabilities and accept that we did the best that we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's great advice. And I think that is something that will give you hope as well on a daily basis to know that you've done your best. And that's part of being kind to yourself too, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, we have just had a wonderful conversation with Dr. Barry Jacobs, and he is the author of the book, The Emotional Survival Guide for Caregivers, Looking After Yourself and Your Family While Helping an Aging Parent. You can get this book at Amazon.com, or you can go to his website at www.emotionalsurvivalguide.com. That again is www.emotionalsurvivalguide.com. Well, thank you so much for talking to us and for all the great advice. And we wish you the very best as you complete your second book. And hopefully we'll talk to you very soon. And we also wish you great blessings as you help your mom through this particular stage.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice.
Don't forget to join us again next Sunday morning from 7:30 to 8 for more tips on lifestyle improvement.